Hi, welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. It is Thursday, November 3rd, and I'm Jessica Steinberg. I'm joined today by political correspondent Jacob Magid and military reporter Manny Fabian. Hello to you both.
Hi, Jessica.
Hey, Jessica.
Hi there. We are more than 24 hours post-election day with Netanyahu headed for this very decisive comeback victory. And Israelis are either thrilled, depressed, or something in between. We'll talk about the results, as well as the latest attack on an IDF officer and an IDF soldier's unexpected time spent in Iran's airport.
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
Jacob, we'll get started with you. You followed Itamar Ben-Gvir, and I found this very fascinating. We can start with this. You compared his election day experience 19 months ago with what he experienced on Tuesday. So you really had this view of his different experiences and what it looked like this week as opposed to that at that moment. You want to start off with that?
Yeah, sure. So I've had the treat of following around Ben-Gvir. I think it's at least three elections at this point. There's been so many, it's hard to keep track. But as I arrived in Kiryat Arba, pretty close to where he lives and where he votes on Tuesday, I kind of had some flashbacks and went back to where he was 19 months ago, when he came to vote as a more fringe candidate. He was likely then at that point also to enter the Knesset for the first time after three previous failed runs. But now this time he was coming totally emboldened. There were photographers, over a dozen, maybe even two dozen photographers and reporters waiting for him in advance to take his picture, get him to say something. Whereas last time he kind of quietly walked in. There were some people who recognized him for sure. It wasn't like nobody was interviewing him all the time then either, but he was still somewhat fringe, and the person in front of him, I remember at the time, didn't even recognize him. As opposed to this time, it was just clear that this is the star of the election, and it was quite interesting and stark the difference to see of so this person who was fringe for so long, and now it took four elections to normalize him, but after the last election, between then and now, he's totally become a star and someone that's accepted by large swaths of the Israeli public, as proven by the exit polls, and now the final tally that's just wrapping up, that looks like Ben-Gvir's party will get 14 seats, which is double what they have right now. So it was also just interesting seeing him being welcomed. He campaigned throughout the south in the morning, and these are mainly Likud strongholds. And Likud still won a plurality in these various towns like Sderot and Kiryat Malachi and Ashkelon and Ashdod. But religious Zionism also made significant gains as well, sometimes doubling its performance from the last time. And it seemed that some of that came at the expense of ultra-Orthodox voters who I spoke with, who said, or a lot of the young people there who said they're moving over to Ben-Gvir. At the same time, we have to look at results and just notice that ultra-Orthodox voters did quite well. Moving from that to the election party, it was very much a party. The exit poll showed the strong results, that music started blasting, a lot of dancing and flag waving, and it was interesting to see the very young crowd of supporters there, hundreds of people, I get some of them there for the first time. Some of them I noticed from previous ones, but the crowds are, they've swelled over the years. And I've been to a couple of these election parties where he didn't cross the threshold, and there's a mood of disappointment in the air that that hasn't been the case the past two times at all, and this time doubly so. And also noteworthy, I think, was his speech at the party where he first was very clear we're going to be enacting change, and he highlighted the importance of reasserting control over the country and the importance of personal safety, and that everyone should be able to walk in their towns and their children should be able to walk in their towns without fearing for their lives, claiming, I guess, that Arab Israelis are attacking them in some of these mixed cities. And he stressed those points, which are said to have helped him win a lot of votes in this previous election. But he also struck a somewhat more conciliatory approach, which is kind of interesting. He talked about his desire to serve the entire Israeli public, and that the Otzma Yehudit Religious Zionism Party actually attracts a wide swath of voters. It's not just religious people, but also secular, and that Judaism is for everyone, not just the religious people. So that was kind of interesting. But then he went and thanked Rabbi Dov Lior, who this is someone who's called for expelling Arabs. And then he's also thanking Bensi Gopstein, who was his former colleague in the party, who was banned from running in the Knesset because of his incitement to violence against Arabs, and someone who campaigns protests regularly the Pride March in Jerusalem every year, and his Lahava organization is against any sort of coexistence. So I think he's trying to, in some ways, distance himself from some of these people in the past, but then he goes and embraces them after he wins. So there's not a lot to base on this assumption that he's going to mellow down his views once he's in government. And we're talking about someone who's likely going to be the next public security minister in charge of the police, who wants to institute quite a few bit of reforms.
The left-wing bloc has really failed miserably. Meretz appears to be completely out of the government. Meretz, one of the most liberal parties in the government. What are your thoughts about that as you sort of look at the juxtaposition of the two, of Ben-Gvir coming to power, Likud coming back into power? How do you see things?
So I'm going to try not to repeat anything that was said yesterday, because some of this was discussed. But I did want to note that there was just between, if you look at the amount of votes for the two different blocks, there was only roughly 8,000 votes that separated the two. Both blocks received roughly 50% of the vote. But the left-wing bloc, or the anti-Netanyahu bloc, had two parties that didn't cross the threshold. So all their votes are scattered across the spectrum, and not all hogged by the bloc that they were supposed to go to. So that's what it really came down at the end to just poor strategizing, which has been talked about. But I do want to hone in on a couple of things. One was Meretz's campaign, which I found to be quite bizarre. Zahava Galon, who was the former chairman, who came back saying she was going to bring the party, breathe life back into the party, and promises not to run what was called a Gewalt campaign. You need to vote for us, otherwise we're going to be gone. And then that's how she started her political comeback, and then she went right back into that strategy in the final weeks before the campaign. There was also this bizarre accusation against Lapid that he was campaigning, and therefore he was taking away votes from both Labor and Meretz, and both Labor and Meretz were accusing Lapid of doing that. I don't know what they really wanted him to do, just like stand and not do anything for the last few weeks. Both of those parties, they kind of focused largely a campaign on Rak Lo Bibi, just not Bibi. Ben-Gvir is horrible. All their campaign ads were, a lot of them were about Ben-Gvir and Netanyahu, which clearly I think is a galvanizing message, but they're not any different than the messaging that Gantz and Lapid's parties are doing as well. And if these parties are talking about the importance of running on their own, especially Labor, but also Meretz, I don't think they really were that upset when they decided in the end, when Mikhaeli refused to do a merger, they decided to run on their own, because they're saying there's two separate parties. In the end of the day, they run a very similar campaign. I think especially Meretz, who talks a lot about the Palestinian issue, at a very small degree, came up in this campaign. I feel like the assumption is that it doesn't win votes, but I think it's a chicken and egg scenario. I think if you want to solve the issue, you have to have it on the national agenda. Major elephant in the room, which is the Arab-Israeli vote, which makes up 15% of Israelis. Only in this election, we had a slight spike. I think a better turnout than what was expected, of around 54 to 57% of Arab Israelis who voted. But that's well below the 71% average that we saw on Tuesday of the entire country. And obviously they're not being maximized to the extent. I think part of this is because Arab Israelis, a lot of them who I talked to when I was in Umm al-Fahim and other places, is that they don't see a difference between whether it's Netanyahu or Bennett or even Ben-Gvir. They say it's all the same. And I think that is because they feel like they're not being really, they're not part of the game. And that's, I think that's why some of them wanted to see Ram again in the Knesset or even in the government. And that's why they received 5 seats. I think it was a vote of confidence to some degree in their decision to join last time. And I get that there's a lot of political differences and cultural and societal differences between people in Tel Aviv and Umm al-Fahim, the leftists in Tel Aviv and the leftists in Umm al-Fahim. But think about that there's probably just as big of a difference between leftist or right wingers in Bnei Brak, the ultra-Orthodox in Bnei Brak, and the traditional people in Sderot. And yet they're in the same political camp and they're cooperating on a very high degree, maybe not in the same party, but there's plenty of political cooperation, and this coalition that Netanyahu is putting together is seen as a natural one. The left, on the other hand, sort of relies on the Arab parties. There's sort of growing cooperation between Lapid and the Joint List over the past year, but it's something that Lapid is very bashful to talk about. Nobody wants to admit it. And then even parties within the Bloc say a campaign on the fact that they're not going to sit or rely on the Arab parties at all. And obviously there is massive political differences on the Palestinian issue. But if there's no sort of partnership, that you're basically trying to run a campaign with a hand behind your back, because it's a demographics issue at the end of the day, is what was talked about yesterday. And if the Haredi public is growing and expanding it with at the rate that it is, you're already at a disadvantage. And in addition to that, you're putting your hand behind your back by ignoring 15% of the population that could well support some of the views that you believe in. And if the, I think the Jewish Israeli left doesn't focus these next, what it could be, 4 years in the opposition to kind of build partnerships with the Arab Israeli community, it could be even longer that they'll be in the opposition, because again, it's a matter of numbers, and ignoring 15% of the population is just not going to be a strategy for success.
All right. We'll see how this all falls out. We are in early days here. Thank you for that, Jacob. We're going to take a quick break. When we're back, Manny will update us on some of the other news headlines.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic, because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so we're back. Manny, there was an IDF officer who was attacked in a car ramming incident. What can you tell us about that?
So on Wednesday morning, the morning after the election night, a Palestinian driver slams into a checkpoint near Modi'in. It's an internal checkpoint in the West Bank. It connects two roads, one that comes from Ramallah, one comes from a Palestinian village called Beit Ur, to the major 443 highway, which connects Jerusalem to Tel Aviv through the West Bank. The soldier, or the officer, more correctly, was hit. He was trapped under the car, and his gun was even slightly kind of squashed and bent in a way. And then the driver got out of the car and attempted to attack the officer with a pickaxe. He didn't manage to actually hit him with it, and the officer managed to shoot back and kill the Palestinian assailant. He was later named as Habas Rayan from Beit Duku, which is nearby. And the officer was taken to hospital in serious condition, but his condition has since improved. He is in a stable condition now, and he is expected to fully recover.
And I know that you also wrote that the assailant, whose two sons had been implicated in other incidents as well, correct?
Right. Two of his sons have served time. One of them is still behind bars, I believe, both of them for various terror offenses.
Okay. Now, and onto something slightly lighter in a sense, after all of this, you had a story about, really, it's shades of the show Tehran, where an IDF soldier was traveling back to Israel from vacation in Uzbekistan. Her plane landed in Iran because of a medical emergency. So many questions about that. How does an IDF soldier on vacation, what kind of flights are they allowed to take? Please tell us anything that you can, because it just sort of takes us away from the headlines of the moment.
Sure. So this is really an incredible story. So this soldier was on her way back from Uzbekistan to Israel, but because there are very few direct flights, or if any, that do that. So she was taking a connection via Dubai. So this flight flies over Iran when it goes from Uzbekistan's capital, Tashkent, to Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. So this happened last Thursday, and it happened right when the government was sitting down in a cabinet meeting to approve the maritime deal with Lebanon.
Timing.
Yeah, the timing is incredible. So this soldier's on her flight. One of the passengers has some sort of medical emergency, and the flight is forced to land, divert and land in Shiraz International Airport in Iran. The passengers, including the soldier, are all taken off the plane into the terminal, where the soldier at that point is really, you know, not knowing what to do. So she sends a message to her parents that she has landed in Iran. Her parents then notify her commanders. Her commanders get in touch with more senior officers, and eventually it reaches the ears of Prime Minister Yair Lapid during this cabinet meeting. At that point, the Mossad also gets involved and tells her not to disclose her Israeli identity, not to speak Hebrew. She's a Russian-speaking soldier, so she managed to get by. She was flying with a foreign passport anyway, which reportedly the foreign passport was issued in Israel, so that may have been written on the passport itself, that it was issued in Israel. But regardless, she presented that passport to the Iranian authorities in the terminal, and but no other incident. And 9 hours later, she was allowed back on the flight, and it flew to Dubai. And then from Dubai, she came back to Israel. One thing I should note, the soldier's not, she's just a young female soldier. She's not in any particular sensitive position. She's in the IDF's Northern Command, nothing, you know, not in any intelligence unit or anything like that. But still, it could have been quite a more serious incident had the Iranians figured out that an Israeli, let alone an Israeli soldier, was in Iranian, or had landed in Iran during this event.
Right. No, must have been an incredibly nail-biting 9 hours for her. I can only imagine. Okay, well, thanks for that, Manny. And we're going to close out today's daily briefing and for the week. Obviously, we'll be following all the news when we start up again on Sunday. And in the meantime, we wish you a Shabbat Shalom and peaceful times. Thank you, Manny. Thank you, Jacob.
Thanks.
Bye, Jessica.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. And thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
And be sure to check out our weekly feature, Times Will Tell, released every Friday. Until next time.
Shalom.